Good morning and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded today, the 2nd of June 2016. Our speaker today is Dr. Janet Turnbull. Janet is a consultant geriatrician at Mary Potter Hospice in Wellington. We are delighted that she can join us today to present. Welcome, Janet. Please go ahead.
Yes. Good day, everybody. Hopefully there won't be too many little problems in this. I've got my instructions ready to start off. I was asked to do this talk. I participated in a seminar run by Mary Potter Hospice entitled The Dying Mind. My brief was to talk about executive function, and I chose to modify the topic a little bit to talk about cognitive impairment and expression and dying. Because I'm a geriatrician by trade, a lot of this talk will be focused on older adults and the problems around the expression of cognitive impairment. But we're going to focus on this particular issue in people who are ill and dying. So next slide, please. The whole seminar was talking about the effect of dying and the mind, and my bit was to focus on the brain bit, I guess. And like many areas, we talk about definitions, and my definition was that the mind was a construct of many, many aspects: the brain, life experience, and the present situation in which we as people find ourselves in, and how do we observe the mind when we're working as health practitioners or friends, family members, people relating to other people. We observe in ourselves and other people, and we listen very closely to the language that they use. We observe and interact with behaviour, which is the emotions and the decisions that they make. And we also see how they are physically, i.e. we observe their movement. Next slide, please. So the outline of the talk is to start off, I'll talk a little bit about some of the patients that I've worked with over too many more years than I care to remember, and their families, and we'll talk a little bit about executive dysfunction in relation to cognitive impairment and how we assess and sort it out and see what the implications of impairment are. We'll touch a little bit on investigations and assessments of people, and then I'll talk a little bit about the impact of cognitive impairment in illness, and also a little bit on people who are dying. And the focus, as mentioned before, will be on the older adult, but some in the questions and how we discuss things, we may be able to extrapolate it to the rest of the population. Next slide, please. So I wanted to talk first a little bit about Brian, the gladioli man. He was the first person I've met, really, that I had quite a long professional relationship when we observed executive dysfunction. He was a man who'd had an intracerebral hemorrhage in his mid-60s. He was said to have had a fantastic recovery. We got a letter from the neurosurgeon saying he'd done extraordinarily well. And effectively, his intracerebral hemorrhage had affected his right frontal lobe. He, in fact, had a total infarction of the right frontal lobe. And as is the case with some of these injuries, he'd had no obvious physical deficit. He walked into my assessment room and talked a little bit about his life. And he said, well, I'm not the same man as I was before the operation, which was quite a significant insight. But his wife had also come with him, and he said, well, he really wasn't the same person at all. He'd recovered extremely well and had come home, but she was somewhat worried and frightened by his presentation. Next slide, please. And what they described him only a little bit, but she most of all described a huge lack of initiative and quite significant apathy. There was a big loss of emotional engagement and relationships with her and the rest of the family and friends. And this was some months after his illness when he'd made his physical recovery. In many ways, he was happy enough. He was functional. He was independent in personal care. And somewhat to my surprise, he was driving. The reason why he's the gladioli man was that he'd headed up the National Society and organised national exhibitions and developed the bulbs and was really and passionate about the flower. He's also a hunting, shooting and fishing man. And he'd really lost all ability to work in these areas. And while he kept his flowers going, he never really went back to any of the activities that he'd had before. And so while he could plant and do things, he couldn't organise himself in the way that he had. And this situation settled down. They managed to accommodate to it, but he didn't really progress or change until he developed a pancreatic malignancy. And this is the next slide, thank you very much. Some years later, he'd had a Whipple's procedure, which, as many of you know, is a very major procedure. And he was deemed to have capacity to consent to this. And as a result of this, it apparently cured his malignancy and he became an insulin-dependent diabetic, but took an inordinate amount of time, many, many months, to be independent and administering his medication. And I was involved with his care. I'd initially seen him as a geriatrician and then as a palliative care physician and as part of the hospice team with metastatic disease. And he slowly became more cognitively impaired over that time. He'd lost his memory and his concentration. And it had considerable problems with pain. His metastatic disease had progressed to his chest, but not to his brain. And it was a difficult time, but eventually he did die. Next slide. His wife, who I also got to know very well, presented following Brian's death with delusions and memory loss. About 4 or 5 years after he died and eventually ended up in care, she'd had progressive cognitive decline. She'd initially presented with delusions about people throwing stones at the house and banging on the door, and she thought they were children playing and then running away. And she had a very fixed idea about these delusions, as one does, and it really was never particularly ameliorated, although medication made a bit of a difference. And she, again, had problems with decision-making. She wished to stay at home, although it became increasingly untenable for her to do so. And she died when in care. The family had managed to get enduring power of attorney for her once we'd diagnosed her cognitive impairment, which was not invoked because she eventually agreed to go into care, but nearly was a few times. So next slide. The next patient I want to talk about is Paul. He'd presented with marked behavioural problems about 2005. He was initially assessed and sorted out a bit further north than the Wellington area, and his initial diagnosis was Alzheimer's disease. He'd had a previous diagnosis, an only major illness, of ischemic heart disease, and he was a very fit man who owned his own business. He was married with children and, to all intents and purposes, enjoying life in his mid-50s. over the next 10 years or 6 or 7 years, he presented with increasing agitation and loss of independence and personal cares. He was eventually admitted to hospital level care. The family had enduring power of attorney but had not been invoked. His journey to hospital level care was very difficult. He had a stay in what we call high dependency care because he'd had profound problems with his behaviour. He'd become sexually disinhibited. He'd been quite distressed, and his relationships with his family were very disrupted and disorganised as a result of this. Because he'd been very physically strong, he needed high-level care because of the risk of unprovoked aggression, and but did start to physically deteriorate after some time, and was admitted to hospital in 2011 with an aspiration pneumonia. And obviously one does find this sort of issue in the end stages of dementia, and he survived in the illness, but I was asked to see him, in fact, only 3 weeks before he died, and at that point I saw evidence, and this is the next slide, thank you, I forgot to say that, of end-stage motor neurone disease. This man was chair-bound. He had fasciculations and wasting of all the muscles of his upper limbs and lower limbs. He was unable to speak and to swallow. And in retrospect, this was probably a presentation of frontotemporal dementia, and then developed into the physical characteristics of what we know as motor neurone disease. And this is an association with frontotemporal dementia and motor neurone disease, which are both ends of the spectrum. And motor neurone disease, as many of you know, was originally thought to be a physical illness with no cognitive manifestations. And this man had a very difficult number of years with the dementia, and it significantly affected his family, and they were paradoxically quite relieved to find out that even though they were told that he'd had a dementia, it felt somewhat easier to understand when it was part of another neurodegenerative disease. So next slide, thank you. The next person I knew for a very long period of time was a Mrs. JL. I first met her early on in her illness when she had behavioural problems in relation to Huntington's disease. She'd had a family history. She was being assessed by a psychiatrist and was really agitated and had unpleasant physical feelings. I saw her rather briefly and then met her after she'd had a diagnosis of carcinoma of the rectum. Because of her increasing dementia, it was felt that she should not have an operative procedure. The carcinoma was already locally invasive when she presented, and she in fact underwent palliative radiotherapy, but she re-presented with a bowel obstruction and underwent a defunctioning colostomy. I do have to say that the request for surgery came from the family. The surgeons themselves were very uncomfortable in doing the procedure. But she underwent it and survived, and she died nearly 30 months later. She was mute and nearly chair-bound. She was cared for very devotedly by her family, and in particular her husband. She has three children, all of whom are positive for the Huntington's gene and who are now at some point, the oldest child probably in the next 10 years and already showing some signs of the illness, may well start to present with some of the dementing signs in relation to Huntington's disease. In particular with Mrs. JL, the carcinoma probably aggravated her deterioration and undoubtedly made managing her physical deterioration very difficult, because she was really unable to communicate how she felt a lot of the time. And obviously the physical deterioration with her dementia went parallel, and it was accelerated by her carcinoma. She died with problems, I suspect, with anemia and physical disability. So a combination of problems there. The next person, if we can have the next slide, please, is Mrs. A. She's a person I met recently and have had very little contact with. She's a patient of the hospice here in Wellington, and she presented with carcinoma of the lung. And she had obvious short-term memory loss when seen. There was apparently no prior assessment of cognitive impairment in this woman, who is very elderly. She's about 89, 90. And her major problem is very, very severe, intermittent and excruciating pain. She was unable to remember symptoms or an emergency plan to deal with this pain when it occurs. And so this poses problems with management. She lives alone. And there's very marked family distress. The family hold an EPOA. They've been struggling to accept that she lacks capacity to make decisions. So they tend to respond to this is what she wants, which was the issue, to live alone. Now, things have progressed since I first assessed her in conjunction with the hospice team, but the major issue was that her executive function was so poor that she was unable to understand the consequences of her illness and the implications, and really wanted to be at home and couldn't see why she couldn't, and couldn't remember a plan or implement a plan when she got severe pain. And this has caused, as many of you are aware, a lot of difficulties in managing her. Next slide, thank you. So the next person is Miss EH. She is still alive. She's in care. She's now 77, and she presented with Parkinson's disease. Probably a good 10 years ago, I saw her when she was admitted to hospital with a prolonged delirium on the initiation of Madopar for her Parkinsonism. And she presented with marked psychosis and agitation. And her delirium provoked a very prolonged hospital stay of about 7 to 8 weeks. And she's displayed marked intolerance of all medications, particularly those used for the management of delirium with psychosis, in particular benzodiazepines and antipsychotics. And so we've been unable really effectively to treat her Parkinsonism for very many reasons. There are medications that we can use to treat psychosis, in particular a drug called clozapine, but there have been issues around compliance and adherence to medications, and also her wishes around her management. She had presented as a very intelligent woman, but there were some subtle problems with her cognition almost from the time of diagnosis, which raises the suspicion, as many of you know, what's called a Lewy body dementia. So that's a dementia that occurs very early on in people with signs of Parkinsonism. And so her cognitive impairment has interfered with the traditional treatment of Parkinson's disease to the point where she's now bedbound. Her daughter, who's been very, very involved in her care, has been distressed with using medication all along, particularly because of the problems she had in the use of Matapar, which actually initiated her marked psychosis and agitation. She's had intermittent delirium for a very long period of time, and this has necessitated her being in care. And this is the cognitive impairment has caused profound problems within the family, which means ongoing specialist involvement in her management, even though she's been in hospital level care now for some 4 or 5 years. Next slide, thank you. So what we're talking about when we talk about the brain and people being ill and dying, the cognitive vulnerability is a term that could be talked about. Many people who develop other illness, who've got problems with a vulnerable brain, have specific problems when they're dying. If we have pre-existing mild cognitive impairment, which is a stage on the way to dementia, which is a progressive cognitive impairment. Some people don't progress, but a certain proportion of particularly elderly people who have mild memory loss or difficulty in making decisions progress over the years to develop frank dementia and then deteriorate, as a couple of the people in the series that I've described. Delirium, as many of you know, is also a problem with cognitively vulnerable patients who actually get acutely distressed. They may hallucinate. They may be obsessed and have paranoid delusions. And this is a difficult problem to treat in people with brain disease and other illnesses. They may get depressed. They may have associated anxiety, which again is very difficult to treat. And in the older adult, there's often coexistent other organ impairments. So people may have mild to moderate or severe renal impairment, heart failure, and particularly hepatic impairment, which aggravates some of the medications that we might use, is aggravated by some of the medications we might use, particularly people who have the genetic problems in managing opiates, but also if they have associated cirrhosis. Again, the problems with incipient encephalopathy and a bad brain can be basically dynamite to deal with, as most of you will know. So next slide, thank you very much. When we're talking about executive dysfunction and cognitive impairment and dementia, the classical illness is frontotemporal dementia, which can present in a number of illnesses which we've talked about. Frontotemporal dementia is now seen as an association with the neurodegenerative diseases in association with motor neurone disease. There's a lot of classification issues and a lot of genetics that I won't go into depth with, but essentially executive function, I hope we've moved on to that slide that says executive function and cognitive impairment and dementia, is the ability to evaluate, decide on, plan and act in almost anything. So it can be either making a cup of tea, and some people may have difficulty with that sort of task, or the complex activity of moving house, figuring out what happens when you're dying, trying to do your job, doing financial issues. So executive function can be many things, and it affects our lives on a momentary, a daily, monthly, and a yearly time scale. So next slide, thank you. Slide 15. So the executive dysfunction is the ability to make reasoned decisions. And then another aspect to that is the capacity. And generally we assess the lack of capacity, like who decides to help this person make decisions. And capacity, when we're talking about it, is a single decision which may prove to be a problem, because you can have capacity to make a number of decisions in your life, but not always every single decision. A sign of emotional dysfunction is what we call emotional liability. So many of you will know or see people who've had stroke or who have a dementia, particularly with motor neuron disease. This is emotional liability is almost like emotional incontinence. So something slightly funny and people laugh and laugh and laugh. And the most distressing aspect of it is a trigger for sadness, and people become profoundly distressed. And it can stop and start, but it's a major inhibitor of social contact. And also, it's very difficult for people to deal with. Another sign of emotional dysfunction is apathy, the lack of ability to enjoy or participate in life. And this is quite destructive for patients and their families. It's very difficult to deal with. It can be a sign of depression or sadness, but actually can be a sign of organic brain disease. And this is what the first man had. He was no longer able to enjoy or engage with what had been a very pleasurable activity in his life. The opposite of that is impulsivity, people racing off and doing things without thinking. This is a sign sometimes of teenage years, when it is said that teenage brains are not as well developed as adult brains. And this is the lack of thinking of consequences, and can be associated with some drugs, particularly in Parkinson's disease, the dopamine agonists are associated with impulsive activities such as gambling and inappropriate sexual behaviour. The other sign that we talk about is concrete thinking. So these are people who think very practically, but cannot raise their eyes above the parapet to actually look at abstract thinking and looking at different ways of approaching a problem. So they always tend to approach the problem in the same way, and this is quite good in people with a dementia who are well ensconced in their routine and they can manage in that way. But when they're faced with a problem, they keep on doing the same thing, which can be quite difficult. So if you've got a dementia and living by yourself, as soon as it becomes cold and you've forgotten to pay the power bill, then you often remain cold, and that can be a health hazard. And the other issue is the lack of flexibility in dealing with progressive memory and language impairment. And this is a sign of a progressive dementia and occurs in most dementias eventually. It's the paramount initial sign in Alzheimer's disease, but in other forms of dementia, it eventually takes over. Next slide, thank you. So the next problems that we talk about is behavioural change, which is risk-taking, gambling, and sexually inappropriate behaviour, and financial management, which are all associated in some forms of frontotemporal dementia, particularly the behavioural variant. And so this is the personality change that people talk about. And so this can be an evolving issue, but the signs initially are very subtle. and change over time. And so suddenly we look back and think, oh, yes, this person cannot actually manage this behaviour. This is not the result of a deliberate choice. You know, this is an actually neurodegenerative disease that are causing major problems for the person. Next slide, thank you. Slide 17. So this leads to problems when people have these issues, and part of our job as health professionals is to assess that person's capacity to make decisions. And in delirium, the issue may be temporary, but it can be permanent. And so how do we assess capacity to make decisions? It's best done extremely slowly and in a quiet place. We have tools. Usually the things that we use are a series of assessments, which we look at numbers, and these are things like the Addenbrooke's assessment, which some of you may know about, or the MOCA, or the Mini Mental. And so those are done, and we come up with a series of numbers. But essentially, the real way to build on those are the experience of the health professional and an understanding of the questions asked. So actually going through these tools with somebody, an experienced health professional can assess or start to assess the capacity of that person to make decisions. So when we assess capacity, we assess for one thing. There's usually a problem. Can this person remain at home? Can they manage their financial affairs? Have they got the ability to drive? But we're not talking about the whole of their life, because one of the problems when you're assessing capacity, you're restricting that person's autonomy in that particular sphere of their action. And then we assess their capacity to donate an EPOA, which usually means that they've got the ability to have prior thought and give consent. If they don't have that ability, we do have the tool which is called the Triple PR, which is the Property Rights Act. And so we do have the difficult job sometimes of imposing restrictions on people's life, and we go to the court and ask them to make a decision on that person's capacity. The next slide, and this is slide number 18. And the reasons that we invariably do this in these particular illnesses are those of people with dementia. So it almost invariably happens that we have to assess somebody's capacity in people with Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia and stroke, and people with frontotemporal dementias, and in Parkinson's disease. It almost invariably happens that if you have Parkinson's disease for long enough, you will develop cognitive impairment. 50% of people with Parkinson's disease will develop a frank dementia, but invariably people have significant problems with cognition. Early on, it's with people with Lewy body dementia, and that traditionally occurs within a year of the signs of Parkinson's disease and what we call the Parkinson's plus syndromes, which some of you will know, which are multi-system atrophy and progressive supranuclear palsy, and a condition we call corticobasal atrophy, which is associated with significant cognitive impairment. Of course, Huntington's disease is the illness that we all associate with dementia. Next slide, thank you. And this is always impaired, always associated with the early signs of mild cognitive impairment. So these are the early problems. People got a bit of memory loss, word-finding problems, which I'm finding is quite difficult in this particular talk. People with mild cognitive impairment are generally independent. Most of them can actually do complex tasks like driving. They often will have insight. But when you test them, they have definite abnormalities on cognitive testing, and these people will progress towards a dementia. Next slide. And when you're doing what we call the MOCA, if you want to go away and look at it afterwards, the particular problems that we have with cognitive impairment, with executive dysfunction, is problems with the word generation test. So we tend not to be able to generate the number of words beginning with any letter. Clock drawing and the association tests, which are trail making tests, and abstract thinking. Next slide, thank you. The investigations I'll run over, which are probably not particularly relevant to this talk. It's good to get a good history and collateral information because often people can't give you good history. To establish a dementia, we have to rule out other problems such as a delirium, depression, and other mental health concerns. Scans improve diagnosis but don't prove it, and they're generally relative negative investigations. Next slide. A couple of words on motor neurone disease. We have a cohort. We had three patients in the last 4 years who've actually presented with a dementia some years before the physical sign, and the cognitive impairment presented as a significant part of their illness. And they're initially seen by psychiatrists, and now they've all combined to present with progressive physical and cognitive impairment. And sorting out their decision making has been a very large part of their management strategy. Next slide, which will be number 23. And the majority of patients at the end stage of motor neurone disease are likely to have some degree of cognitive impairment, especially obviously in advanced disease. And this is important. I've often wondered in patients such as these who may be overrepresented in people who seek assisted dying. It's just a comment to make. I don't really have any clear evidence to say that this is a real feature, but it's been a feature in some of the people that I've worked with. And so it may be their ability to sort out their experience and what their expectations of life are. Next slide, which will be number 24. Their cognitive ability and their executive function is made worse by their ability to communicate, which is often very impaired, as you know. And really what the viability or the utility of interventions are, particularly in non-invasive investigation and PEGs. And at what point do these problems with executive functions become critical? Carer stress, as most of you know, is a huge issue in motor neurone disease. And people who've had personality change and difficulty, it's very difficult to actually deal with without a lot of support. Next slide, thank you. Parkinson's disease, as I've already mentioned, cognitive is inevitable if you live long enough. The particular problems in association with this are the medication burden, which exacerbates the problems with cognitive impairment, which includes fairly frequent drug-induced delirium at the end of life and significant behavioural change. The primary medications which improve motor symptoms are particularly implicated in delirium, and the Parkinson's plus syndromes do have a significantly earlier association with cognitive impairment. Next slide, thank you, which is number 26. Parkinson's disease patients usually have a longer life expectancy now, but Parkinson's plus syndromes, the ones that I've talked about, multisystem atrophy and PSP and corticobasal degeneration, have a very short life expectancy. Multisystem atrophy is only 5 or 6 years, and a very rapid progression towards executive dysfunction, loss, frontolobe syndromes, high risk of hallucinations and psychosis. So these people have very difficult dementia to deal with and are increasingly presenting to palliative care agencies. Next slide, which is number 27. In the next 10 to 15 years, we may be dealing with a lot of other illnesses that pose the same problems as Huntington's disease. We can now predict people who will develop Huntington's disease as a result of genetic testing. And with dementia, as we can see, there's a combination of cognitive and physical decline. It's relatively rare, but increasingly common, particularly people dealing with dying, which inevitably happens to all of us. And it spans the whole age range. And occasionally Huntington's disease presents late without a family history, which means that if you're dealing with it early on, you have to deal not with just the person who has the illness, but the rest of the family who are faced with very difficult decisions. With an increasing genetic sophistication, we may be faced with this position in people who present with motor neurone disease and possibly with Alzheimer's disease. Next slide. So obviously this leads us on to advanced care planning. I don't need to really emphasise this issue to a palliative care audiences. But early on, obviously, we have to make plans, and it's a process rather than a document. And ongoing education to the person and their family is very useful, but it is more difficult in people with dementia because executive function and reasoning are extremely useful in forward planning. And so guidance and structure required, and there needs to be direction in many activities. So this is a bit of a plug to you all to go out and get your enduring power of attorney before you actually ever need it. Next slide, thank you. Slide number 29. So what do we see with the patient with cognitive impairment who's dying with other illness? The older illness with cancer or organ dysfunction. Their prognosis is invariably poorer. Care burden is larger. There's marked problems with frailty, and vulnerability is the key word here. I always see that there are ongoing concerns with hypoactive delirium. So people can improve at times. And so our advice to carers is to treat the problems that arise, and we don't always have to opt for the status quo, but it may be that people can deteriorate quite quickly, particularly with delirium. Next slide, thank you. So the patients and their families often have to be able to follow through with management plans, but because of frailty, there's an increased risk of physical dependency fairly early on, earlier on than the stage of malignancy that you might expect. And this is frailty in particular, which is a new buzzword, is associated with mild cognitive impairment. It does have effects on decision making, and frailty is often under-recognised by health professionals. And we tend to characterise frailty by talking about people as frequent flyers and that they've got acopia, which is a horrible word to use about a very real problem. Next slide, thank you, which is number 31. So when we talk about frailty, it's a term which indicates a set of conditions which indicate an underlying vulnerability to deteriorate in unfamiliar environments, especially in the context of acute illness. And there are a number of physical problems that I won't go into in depth here, but it's a new term that we can characterise the problems that are associated with older age and ageing, which are pathophysiological in this context. Next slide, thank you. Cognitive impairment is an important aspect of frailty, and if it's not managed well, it's as risky as an advanced malignancy and has a very poor prognosis. So advanced frailty, these are the people that have difficulty getting in and out of chairs and walking distances and fall over regularly. These people probably will die within a year or two. And this indicates that it is important to assess and combine with the concerns around age, to reduce the multiple medication burden and look at increasing support in these patients. Next slide, thank you. And this brings us to the issue of deconditioning, which is a word I don't particularly like, but it's come into parlance, which encompasses the potential to develop both physical and cognitive decline in a hospital admission. And deconditioning can happen within a couple of days. All it requires is lying on an ED bed for 12 hours. It's characterised by decreased mobility, impaired cognition. People may have a delirium. They may have incontinence and associated with increased falls and pressure areas. Next slide, thank you. And obviously, frailty, like everything else, is associated with carer burden, which is very high in people with neurodegenerative disease and impaired function. Carer burden, the difficulty in caring for people who can't care for themselves, is socially isolating, associated with fatigue. And in the older adults, as a geriatrician, you often get two patients for the price of one assessment, and both people may well have cognitive impairment. And in older adults, they always have high expectations of themselves and being able to do more than is usually physically possible. So, this is the last slide, number 35. Next slide. This is the issue for discussion. How do we assess cognitive impairment and the various sorts at the bedside? When should we assess cognitive impairment? And the other thing is capacity assessment, when and who should do it, and many other topics, hopefully. That's the last of my discussion.
That will conclude today's conference call. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.